When it comes to the lean executive recruiting landscape, staying ahead means staying informed. Subscribing to the Stiles Associates email list gives you access to the latest compensation data, industry analysis, and career resources straight from their recruiting team. Plus, you'll receive hand-picked career opportunities from leading companies, whether you're seeking new challenges or just curious about the market. So head over to leanexecs.com and sign up to get on the Stiles Associates email list and transform the way you make strategic decisions for your company and your career. Thanks for listening. Did you know I can help your organization on this journey of cultivating a culture of learning and innovation? I can be a trainer, coach, and advisor on topics including psychological safety, problem solving, and continuous improvement. I can add value to your management team meetings by speaking and facilitating discussions on these important topics. To learn more, visit markgraben.com or email me, mark@markgraben.com. Let's improve together.
Welcome to the Lean Blog Podcast. Visit our website at www.leanblog.org. Now, here's your host, Mark Graben.
Hi, this is Mark Graben. Welcome to episode 320 of the podcast. It's October 9th, 2018. Skip Stewart, the Chief Improvement Officer at Baptist Memorial Healthcare in Tennessee, was a guest on episode number 314 of the podcast, talking about training within industry and Toyota Kata in healthcare. He was joined by Brandon Brown. Well, today I've asked Skip to come back and chat with me one-on-one here in episode 320 about his experience with Don Wheeler, learning from W. Edwards Deming, and many other topics. I hope you enjoy his reflections, our discussions about healthcare, and connections to my book, Measures of Success. And I think Skip undoubtedly has a book in him. I hope he writes it someday. I hope he comes back on the podcast. So if you want to find links to everything we talk about here, Skip and Baptist have a great YouTube channel. I would encourage you to go check that out. You can find links to all of that by going to leanblog.org/320. Well, Skip, hi. Thank you for coming back this time to the podcast. How are you today?
I'm doing great, Mark. Thank you for having me back.
Well, I'm glad we'll have a chance to explore some things that we just barely touched on the last time you were on the podcast. We'll just jump right in. I'm curious, how did you get introduced to Dr. Deming's work and philosophy?
So when I started my career in 1992, I was at that time in an industrial engineering, quality engineering role, and I had also enjoyed statistics and tutored folks in statistics in college. And I was sent to some workshops with Dr. Don Wheeler, the gentleman that endorsed your new book of Measures of Success. And Dr. Wheeler was very kind that for some reason he took me under his wing. And I would call him on a regular basis. And then I would start going to Knoxville, Tennessee, where a lot of his workshops were. And I would go to his understanding statistical process control, or I went to his advanced class. One of my favorite ones was evaluating the measurement process, which is using process behavior charts for measurement equipment, and so on and so on. But during those same workshops, Dr. Wheeler would introduce us to Dr. Deming. Mm-hmm. And give us, that's where I think I got my very first Out of the Crisis book. Mm-hmm. And I met a lady at that workshop named Margaret, and she was an assistant to Dr. Deming up at, I believe it was New York State or the university he was connected to up in New York. Mm-hmm. I may be wrong about the name of the university, but she was a very kind lady, and she would send me articles of Dr. Deming that he was, that he had written, and so I was introduced that way. And if you remember that back at that time, we didn't have the internet. So we had VHS tapes, and I would get these tapes from Margaret and others about if Japan can, why can't we, the famous NBC interview that they did with him. And so I was just soaking it all up about Dr. Deming's view and what happened in Japan, and not only his experience with things like statistical process control, what we call process behavior charts today, but also his perspective on how we should treat people, how management should think about managing an organization. So that was my initial introduction. And also I was introduced, it kind of became a domino effect. I was introduced to the work of Dr. Brian Joyner, which I really enjoyed a lot, with his book, Fourth Generation Management. Mm-hmm. Yep. Went to some of his workshops, and then also Peter Schultes, which was also part of, went to some of his workshops, and he was involved heavily. And I was wrestling through what Dr. Demings and Peter Schultes and Dr. Joyner and Dr. Wheeler, for sure, mm-hmm. would do is they made me wrestle through, why do I believe in what I believe in, and how should I think about, as a young professional, how should I think about things like what I call today purpose, people, and process? How should I think about that? And Dr. Wheeler, he was always so kind to let me call him anytime, and he would always answer my calls on it. I think at one time I probably called him every month for several years, but there were times when I tend to have to wrestle through things to get them in my little brain. And I can't tell you the number of times that Dr. Wheeler would say, Skip, have you ever read chapter 3 of this book? Oh yeah, Dr. Wheeler, I've already read that. No, no, you didn't understand it. Go back and read it and call me again. And so that was kind of my initial introduction.
Yeah. Well, so there's a lot to sort of, you know, unpack and dig into there. You know, for one, I did look up, because I wasn't sure either. I forgot. Dr. Deming was teaching at NYU.
That's right. That's right.
At points in his career. And, you know, I think I'll tell the listeners, I think I've told you this privately, Skip, that I'm going and taking Don Wheeler's 4-day workshop in Knoxville in the second week of September.
That's great.
So I'm really looking forward to that, because, you know, his book, Understanding Variation, you know, has been incredibly influential to me. My dad took a class Dr. Wheeler taught at General Motors, probably in the mid-90s. And my dad, as an engineer, had that book around, and that was some of my earliest introductions. So I'm really, really excited to go and get beyond the books and learn more and see how he teaches it. And I'm really looking forward to that.
Well, that's great. I highly recommend it.
So he's got, and he's got other books that, you know, I've discovered, you know, in the past year that take a lot of deeper dives into this topic. And one other thing you mentioned, the NBC program, if Japan can do this, why can't we? The Deming Institute was able to get the rights, and that's available freely now on YouTube. That was a show from 1980. Have you been able to revisit that at all recently?
You know, I did go back and look at it on YouTube. It was a while back. But the ones that I personally enjoy the most is a friend of Dr. Deming, someone that worked with Dr. Deming in the early days, was a gentleman by the name of Dr. Russell Acuff. Mm-hmm. And many people refer to Dr. Acuff as the father of systems thinking. Yeah. And there's a couple of YouTubes out there. There's lots of YouTubes of him talking, but there's one out there of him and Dr. Deming talking and having a conversation. Yeah. And then there's one with Dr. Russell Acuff with Dr. Deming's secretary. And they asked him a question. They said, we noticed that you always called Dr. Deming's Ed. You never called him. And he said, why is that? He said, well, because we grew up together. He said, that's what he was. He said, I was Russ and he was Ed. And it's kind of neat to see that origin. But it also was very neat to wrestle through their thinking and to see how they thought about things and why. And I think both of those men left us lessons, but unfortunately, some of those lessons we have to keep on learning. We haven't seemed to learn many of them. When I was reflecting back with Dr. Deming and with Dr. Russell Acuff, I was somewhat surprised on how maybe we haven't still learned some of those lessons.
Yeah. And, you know, we can talk about, I think you and I are in agreement. A lot of these lessons are incredibly relevant today, even though Dr. Deming passed away in 1993. I think in a lot of ways he was very, very far ahead of his time. And, you know, he was really, in a way, introduced to a broad American audience in that NBC program. So I'll link to that in the show notes. You know, it's really, really fascinating to see, because I think Dr. Deming in the U.S. was sort of unknown or underappreciated compared to his work in Japan. And, you know, when I've been to Japan in recent years, seen, you know, hospital executives and business leaders bring up Dr. Deming quite frequently, that he had a huge influence. I believe the Deming Prize is, I don't know for a fact if the Deming Prize is still an active prize, sort of like the Baldrige program mm-hmm. in the U.S., but Dr. Deming is still very revered over there, I think, for good
reason. And that was my experience, too. I mean, first of all, my wife tends to tease me a lot that my friend Margaret, that works for Dr. Deming, she had him sign a book to me in 92, and then he passed away in, like you said, 93. And my wife always teases me when you play those newlywed games, you know, type or games, you know, if the house was burning, what's the one thing you would grab? And my wife, oh, he would grab that, you know, Dr. Deming book on the shelf, you know. And so, and, you know, but when I have talked to Toyota executives, I find it interesting that two things that they'll bring up to me in conversation, these are just run-of-the-mill type folks, these aren't necessarily high profile, is that they'll bring up Dr. Deming's name and they'll bring up a PDCA. Mm-hmm. And I find that very interesting.
Yeah. And I think that'll be familiar to a lot of listeners. I think, you know, hopefully people would recognize that as being part of lean thinking, you know, plan, do, check, act, or, you know, we could talk for a whole half hour about, you know, words and terminology, plan, do, study, adjust. A lot of people in healthcare say PDSA, or you have variations of plan, do, study, act. That is, people will call it the Deming cycle. Dr. Deming called it the Schuhart cycle after Walter Schuhart, who kind of preceded Dr. Deming. And yeah, there's companies in Japan. And there's an interesting language that's used to kind of dive into this a little bit. They'll say, spin the PDCA cycle. And they really mean cycles of, you know, this is sort of, you know, and that makes me think of, like, you know, there's motion and momentum.
Kind of interesting. Well, you know, what's funny is that I was talking, I've done some work with Mr. Yoshino that mm-hmm. was John Shook's boss that knew me and done a lot of work with Katie Anderson. And I remember one time we were down in Mississippi having dinner, and I can't remember how the conversation came up, but I said something to the effect of, you know, in your 40 years of at Toyota, what was the one thing that impacted you and you learned the most? He didn't even blink an eye. He said, PDCA. And then he goes on to say, Skip, it took me 10 years to learn each letter.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I kind of laughed when he said that, but then I kind of walked away thinking, I'm not sure he's completely making a joke out of this.
Yeah. Well, like a lot of things, I mean, on the surface, it seems so simple. And I think that's one kind of fascinating thing about a lot of lean concepts. When you really kind of, you know, unpack it and practice, and then you start realizing what you don't know.
Right.
Like in recent years, I was introduced to a term. I don't think somebody was accusing me of it, but there's times I'm guilty of it. Dunning-Kruger syndrome, or the Dunning-Kruger effect. It's a psychological term that says, you know, it's kind of human nature. When somebody is first learning something, we all tend to overestimate our understanding. Right. And I see this with lean. It could probably happen with PDCA. Someone goes to initial class and they think, oh, I learned that, and kind of like the past tense, I know that.
Right.
And then we go and struggle and maybe kind of realize now we know what we don't know.
But, you know, that's a really good point, even. And that's even a discussion in itself. What you're talking about is the difference between knowledge and skill, you know, knowledge and skill are so radically different. And I've learned that again, you know, with my daughter, the last year I've been trying to teach her how to drive, and she's doing really well now. But when we first started, very smart young lady went and took a driving test and aced it. Big deal. I put her in the car. She didn't know where the brake was or the gas pedal, or didn't know what any of the mirrors were for. So she had knowledge, but no skill. And so even, you know, at Baptist Memorial Healthcare, where I work, and with the Baptist management system, we think a lot about the difference between knowledge and skill. I can do a workshop on, you know, various subjects, but that doesn't mean you have skill.
Right.
And we have a whole industry out there that they do lots and lots of training, but that doesn't mean the person, you know, has skill. And so I continue to reflect on that, and what does it take to bring about skill? And that kind of builds on what you're saying.
Yeah. And as we talked about in the last podcast, when you and Brandon Brown, you know, we're talking about training within industry, there's the idea that the teacher needs to validate that the student has learned,
and, right,
and not just fall back on say, well, you attended the class, therefore I assume you absorbed it and can put it to use. Effective training goes beyond that, right?
Well, you're absolutely right. I'm really glad. So we do a tremendous amount of TWI, training within industry, job instructions, job relations, and job methods. And what I continue to discover, to build on your earlier point, is that there's much profoundness and simplicity. And so that even that phrase, if the worker hasn't learned, the instructor hadn't taught, John Wooden has said to have been connected to that. He used that in his coaching. But sometimes I'll actually have folks that get a little offended with that statement, mm-hmm, because they'll say, well, what do you mean? You know, because they fall so in love with their PowerPoint slides, yeah, or whatever it might be. You know, even in our TWI class, what we'll tell people with the job instructions, it's a 10-hour class, and you may have been very engaged in the class. It's 2 hours each day, Monday through Friday, but you don't really have any skill. We've brought you intensely aware of the subject, and you have to do a project in the class. But we then have a responsibility to come up after the class and do a validation and verification process, to where we have to see, did you really learn that new skill, and is that new skill growing and learning? Mm-hmm. And it's even true with the process behavior charts and understanding variation and all the things that you write about in the measures of success. One of the quotes from your book that I really liked a lot was, don't ask me what page it's on, but it said something to the effect of,
don't ask me either.
It said, it's better to have the thinking, mm-hmm, without the tools than it is the right, without the tools than it is to have the tools without the right thinking. And I really like that quote a lot. Dr. Wheeler used to always say something to the effect of that, that the SPC charts or the process behavior charts was a way of thinking, and that the chart acted as a catalyst for this thought process. But without the way of thinking, that the chart had nothing to act upon.
Yeah. Yeah, he said, you know, what I wrote, I think inspired by Dr. Wheeler, and I cited him in my book. SPC, process behavior charts, are a way of thinking with some tools attached. You could say the same thing about Lean. You know, A3 problem solving is a tool, the template, and it's not even the specific template. You know, start with a blank sheet of paper. It's the way of thinking. Right, because you could download a template from the Lean Enterprise Institute, and jump to a solution in the title of the A3,
right?
Or you could write out the A3 to sort of finagle your way to a predetermined solution. That's not what the A3 thinking is supposed to be. And if someone's teaching A3 thinking, there need to be those checks. And I think of it as I'll bring it back to a PDCA cycle. You might call it plan, teach, evaluate, adjust, or whatever letters you want to use, right? Because the way you or I are communicating something to one person might not resonate the same way with a different person. So this is what I feel the challenge of teaching a class of 20 people in it. Those are 20 unique individuals with 20 unique sets of backgrounds and comfort level with statistics or lean or Excel or what have you.
Well, and you're right. And, you know, the other thing that makes a lot of that a challenge is going back to that skill acquisition is sometimes within the lean community, we tend to violate, in my opinion, our own thinking. For example, we tend to do batch teaching. And so for example, let me go back to the TWI. The way that class is set up, we do no more than 10 people, and it's 2 hours each day. And I've probably personally taught that class, 50 to 60 times. What's very interesting to me, watching human behavior, is that right at 2 hours, people's eyes will tell you they're done.
Yeah, that's all I can take in.
That's all I can take. You know, I've digested as much as I can take. Now, if we want to go out and do some work, that's great. But sitting in a class, I can only digest so much. But a lot of times, I'll have people call me and ask me. And as you know, Mark, I'll give any help I can give. But I can't tell you how often someone will say, well, can we just knock this thing out in one day? Well, yeah, we could academically, but is that what's best for the student? You know, are they going to really learn from me shoving 10 hours in an 8-hour day? And so we want to batch it through, but that's really not what's best mm-hmm. for the person that's learning and growing from that skill.
Yeah. Well, and that's an interesting question you raise of, do we violate lean principles? And I try to be mindful of this as well. I'm trying not just to not point fingers at others. I know you're reflecting and not pointing fingers.
No, that's right.
Yourself, Skip. But one thing that comes to mind is, telling versus engaging. And, you know, this is something, and I've done a couple podcasts about an approach called motivational interviewing, which is, kind of a newer school of counseling and therapy. And one thing, and I think there are a lot of connections to lean thinking, or we could connect it to Deming, where, they'll say the old model of therapy was the therapist as expert, the mm-hmm. therapist telling the patient what to do. And it turns out that's not very effective, or it's not very sustainable. You get compliance instead of real intrinsic change. Dr. Deming talked about intrinsic motivation. And so motivational interviewing puts the counselor in the role of coach, of helping the patient, or we could think of helping a client or helping an employee work through their own change process.
Right.
Instead of telling them what to do, asking them, why is this important to you? And that really helps activate intrinsic motivation, allowing someone to convince themselves to change. This is not manipulating them, but this is asking questions, being supportive, having their best interest in mind. You know, there's sort of thoughts that come from this approach asking, these are challenging questions. Like, do you want to be right? Or do you want to help that person? Sometimes being right feels good, and there's human nature in that, but it doesn't help the other person. So anyway, to wrap up the thought, though, I see the irony, and I've been guilty of this at times, and I see leaders do it, telling people in a very top-down way, you need to participate in continuous improvement, which seems kind of ironic.
Right?
It seems to miss some of the spirit. It's well-intended for the individual in the organization, or there's that advancement of like, well, I'm telling you to do it and I'll explain why, as opposed to asking the employee, why would you want to participate in continuous improvement, and getting them to articulate that. So
I completely agree. I was introduced a year or so ago with some books from a group called the Arbinger Group, and they have one called The Outward Mindset. And it kind of builds on a lot of what you were just saying. You know?
Yeah. And I heard somebody talking about that yesterday at our KineXus user conference. And I met one of the Arbinger Institute people. I've got one of their books, Leadership and Self-Deception, I need to pick up and read. But that seems like a scary book to give someone, because I'm like, well, are you accusing them of self-deception? That's
well, and I think you were building on something really important there. Mark, a lot of folks completely understand the whole wanting or maybe falling into the quote unquote expert role, but really, I think doing a really good job of coaching really comes with a lot of humility, right? Because I want the real people that do the real work in our healthcare system, I want them to be the experts.
Right.
So we've been working with some partners like Intermountain and others. And at first they'll call and someone will say, Skip, could you come help kick off XYZ, TWI, job instructions, whatever it may be. And what I try to do and have been successful so far at doing is saying, well, you don't really want me. They'll say, no, that's why we're calling you. I'll say, no, don't you want like a real nurse or a real practitioner that really touches patients and really does? Well, wow, yeah. In other words, we try to connect them up with those people because that's what we're trying to do. And that's what I think, you know, Deming, there's so many things that I was looking through out of the crisis last night, knowing you and I were going to talk. And it was one of those, wow, look at what's been sitting on my bookshelf. Mm-hmm. And
there was some nugget or gem that.
Yeah. Reason that I loved your Measures of Success book, the reason I just loved it and plan on reading it a second time was it was a good positive nudge on saying, Skip, remember how you started your career off? And it was like all these thoughts came flushing through, but it came flushing through in a nice, fresh way because you gave some different perspectives and some different thoughts. And just, and I'm not saying this for you, and I know you haven't asked me to do this, but I highly recommend the Measures of Success book because I think it reintroduces a dialogue that maybe someone has forgotten about.
Yeah. Well, thank you. And so maybe, you know, let me bring it back to, I'll say likewise, real experts like Dr. Wheeler. I wanted to come back and sort of dig deeper into, you know, earlier you brought up the idea and we can frame it in terms of what you learned, you know, from Wheeler or Deming, but, you know, statistical process control, process behavior charts. And then this idea, I want to hear more about what you said around how we should treat people because, you know, I think Dr. Deming sometimes gets labeled and described as a statistician, which I think sells him short. Mm-hmm. You know, he in his System of Profound Knowledge that he wrote about in his later book, The New Economics, he talks about the importance of psychology. And I'm pretty sure he said at one point, the most important thing for a manager to understand is psychology and to understand their employees as unique individuals, which to me sounds like Toyota and respect for people. And, you know, there's theory of knowledge and how do we learn? But anyway, I'd be curious, you know, just to tee up those thoughts, you know, first, could you give, you know, from your perspective, maybe a bit of a summary of process behavior charts and what would your elevator pitch be as you're introducing or reintroducing this to people, maybe in your workplace?
Yeah. So as we're starting to introduce, you know, one of the things that, once again, I always take a little phrase from my friend Pascal Dennis. He always calls it drip, drip, drip. So you can only introduce stuff so much. But we have, at the Baptist Management System, been focused on showing people a certain framework of thinking and an approach by what means we will improve, as Dr. Deming would say it. But what you so did such a great job in your book of reminding me is we've got to let people also know, how do they know if they actually have improved? Mm-hmm. And so We've definitely introduced run charts that, you know, that doesn't seem like a big deal, but in healthcare, a lot of people don't necessarily use run charts. So we've introduced run charts to let them see that variation. But as I've literally started in the last couple weeks or so, even after kind of having a wake-up call from your book, is that I've handed out, I've introduced them to your book, and I've handed out Dr. Wheeler's book, Understanding Variation, and I've taken some of our data, even as of today, and had a conversation. I was looking at some readmission rates, and I was and falls, and I was talking to some people about the data, and started off the conversation with people I knew that I could have a conversation with, because at first, when you introduce people to process behavior charts, it's going to hit their paradigms in a hard way. It's going to, and so I wanted to make sure that I, in a very respectful manner, let them know what the data said. And right. So we had one chart that of one hospital where they were looking at the readmission rates. And I asked them, I said, do you think that you've gotten better over the last couple of years? It is natural and almost automatic to say, oh yeah, we've gotten better.
Right.
Hardly anyone's going to say, oh, we've gotten worse. And I said, well, would you be open to having a conversation about what I'm seeing in your data? And I explained to them, and I said, there is something that you may not be aware of called the voice of the process. And now at this point in time, I've got 4 years, 5 years built into a relationship with this person of treating each other with mutual respect. And so I knew I could have a conversation with that person. And I said, well, there is something called process behavior charts. And I tell them a little bit about where they came from. And I normally just show them the individual X chart, you know,
Of the data. Or
in this scenario, I actually showed them both the individual X chart and the moving range, because this particular CEO liked statistics. And I said, okay, let's just talk about it. Mm-hmm. And I said, let me tell you what each little data point is. It's, you know, the overall readmissions divided by the discharges, you know, so how we came up with the percentage. And it was 2.5 years, almost 3 years worth of data. And I said, this chart is incredibly predictable. Now, at first, they tend to want to smile as if that's...
And by predictable, sorry to interrupt, but you mean like, you know, the metric's just fluctuating around some average.
It's fluctuating around the average, and it is statistically consistent.
Yes. Yep.
And so it's very consistent. And so that's what I mean by predictable. There is not any unusual things going on. It's just, it goes up, it goes down, it's fluctuating around the average. And so I explained how the limits was developed, but I said, we refer to this as the voice of the process. So if the chart could talk to you, it would tell you this. It would say, I'm doing the very best that I can do. On the average, I'm going to be at, I think it was like, I want to say it was like at 15%. On the average, I'm going to have a readmission rate of 15%. But on any given month, I could be as low as 8% or at 20-something, like 24-something%.
Right.
And none of that is unusual. Let me explain that again. So I'll go into saying, so on any given month, if you had a readmission of 8%, it doesn't mean you should have a pizza party. Mm-hmm. And if you had a readmission 1 month of 20-something, 21%, let's call it, it doesn't mean that anyone should get in trouble. The process is I'm doing the very best that I can do, it would tell you. If you don't like me, then you better change me.
If you don't like that range, right? So yeah, those what you described, I've had people read the book and write and say, yeah, that's really familiar. People get too excited about every uptick and they get too upset about every below average point. And then, you know, the other common dynamic is someone calculates those natural process limits that are, like you said, the chart talking to us. And they say, well, I don't like those limits. Those limits are too wide. Well, that's back to your point of, well, then you need to improve the system, right?
Well, and that's funny you said that's a good example, because one of the things that I think we've been conditioned at in our society is we tend to spend so much time thinking about the voice of the customer. That could be a specification. It could be a Medicare target. It could be a Medicare penalty if you go over a certain threshold. These are all, not to say they're not important. I don't want to imply that. But those are all targets and metrics that are outside of the process. The process doesn't even know that those exist. It's leadership's requirement to line up the voice of the process and the voice of the customer. And so a lot of times people will do like you just said, they'll say, well, that's unacceptable. And I understand why they would say that. But that metric, by what's making them say that's unacceptable, that's the voice of the customer.
Right.
The voice of the process says, I'm doing the very best that I can do. If the variation from month to month is too high for you, then you need to fundamentally change how you're playing the process. Or to use a sports analogy, I'm kind of excited that college football starts tomorrow. And
For me, it started last night.
It started last night. Okay. Yeah. Was it successful?
Northwestern won, yes.
Good. Good. Well, But in the analogy, you know, a lot of times sports fans, college football, especially down here in the SEC, they get very emotional. Mm-hmm. And they'll talk about, they don't like the outcome. Well, if you don't like the outcome, then you're going to have to change how you're playing the game.
Right.
And a lot of times they'll even use analogies of being a victim. And I'll name a certain team. I'll say, well, do you know that this team right here has more NFL players than any team? Mm-hmm. And they're not even close to the national title discussion every year. So it's not about having the best players as it is about how you're playing the game.
Right. Well, I'm pretty sure this is before we started recording, you were talking about a system. And you used the car analogy. I think you cited Russell Acuff. I've heard Atul Gawande use the example of you take you benchmark the auto industry and look for best practices. We'll take an engine from Lamborghini and a transmission from Honda and seats from Mercedes, and you collect all those parts, you wouldn't have a functioning car.
That's right.
And I think the same is true with football. You could recruit all of the best five-star individual players, but that doesn't always make a system either, right?
That's right. That's exactly right. That's exactly right. And it's the same thing with healthcare. So my daughter had to have her appendix removed in January. My daughter never said, Dad, what a great lab, what a great radiology, what a great ED, what a great discharge process. She was traveling horizontal through the process.
Right.
We tend to focus vertically, and we call them silos. And the funny thing about that, Mark, is everyone recognizes that silos exist.
Right.
But recognizing it isn't enough. You have to understand how do all the parts interplay together.
Yeah. So I want to come back. You know, you talked about some of those dynamics with process behavior charts that, you know, people working within that system are doing as well as the system will allow. So that, you know, it's one thing to make the chart, but this comes back to the question of how we should treat people, right?
Right.
Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Yeah, I'd love to. So a phrase that we like to use a lot with the Baptist Management System is purpose, people, and process. And I would argue that Dr. Deming was talking about all four or all three of those when he gave us the 14 points. I think his very first point was, you know, create constancy of purpose for improvement of product and service. So that's purpose. He talked a lot about people when he talked about eliminating slogans, when he talked about eliminating numerical quotas for the workforce, and so on. One of his points was remove barriers that rob people of pride and workmanship. Obviously, we know he talked a tremendous amount about process, but at the end of the day, people, you're not going to get anything done without people. And I think that the folks out there in California with the, what's the car called? I just went blank.
Tesla?
Tesla. I think they're learning, hopefully they're learning that you need people. So one of the...
Well, and just to interrupt real quick, you know, Elon Musk, you know, at this point, maybe it's a famous expression. He said, humans are underrated. You know, when he had this vision of an incredibly automated Model 3 line, and then they were having all kinds of trouble, and they basically slapped together a secondary assembly line in a tent that was very manual, and he said that was performing better. Mm. And then he tweeted, humans are underrated.
Mm.
Mm. Yeah. But are they really learning from that, or was that just a temporary detour until they get the robots working?
That's right. You know, here's the thing I've always discovered with our work that we do is that people will always surpass even what I think they have the ability to do. Humans are so incredibly creative, amazingly creative, that when that is channeled correctly, wow, watch out. But some of the things that we think about is we, TWI job relations is a very important piece of our Baptist management system. For me, it's the best way that I personally know on how to operationalize respect for every individual. And I can't tell you the number of people, once they go through JR, job relations, and they start practicing it, they'll come and they'll say, Skip, they almost have a confession time that they'll tell me and Patrick Gropp that from the TWI Institute that you know, Mark. They'll say something like, they'll say, I've been a leader for 20 years or 25 years, and I've just realized that my job is not just to watch people and write them up when they step outside the rules, but my job is to have a relationship with them. Like right. we have a phrase that we say in the class that leaders have followers. Now that doesn't sound very profound, but I think there's much profoundness simplicity, because you are not a leader just because of your title or because of your degrees or certifications. You're a leader if you have a follower. So I have people in our Baptist management system that I could pick up the phone right this moment and say, I need you to run through a brick wall for me. Now, they don't report to me.
Right.
They could not even answer the call, but they're willing to do that because, you know, and so I think that's very important. Right. And then,
yeah. Well, I just want to add a thought there, bringing it back to Peter Schultes, who you mentioned earlier.
Yeah.
You know, I think, you know, people, someone may formally, they may be told they report to you, quote unquote, but they choose, I think this is what you're saying, they choose to follow you. I'll bring it back, before coming back to Schultes, I think one of the key insights of motivational interviewing is that you can't make anybody change. People choose to change. If they're not choosing, that's just compliance, and that's not sustainable. And the Peter Schultesism that I always come back to, he says, people don't resist change, they resist being changed.
Right.
And so, you know, I think you could make the argument that generally speaking, forcing people to change in some cases might be necessary, but it's probably disrespectful, and it's not as sustainable as working with people and helping lead so that in a way that allows them to choose a change. And again, I don't mean manipulating them, but leading.
Sure.
Letting people, you know, respecting individuals, treating them like adults, letting them have input and think and come around. And that's slower than saying, well, do it because I said so. Right?
Well, and that's a great point. And to keep on building on that, a lot of times what some people refer to as catch ball, one CEO in our system refers to it as, no, they're not doing catch ball, they're doing catch anvil. I mean,
Catch Anvil.
And I'll give you a great example of catch ball and respect. So my boss that you've met, Dr. Paul DePriest, he does the best example I've ever seen in 5 years. He'll shut the door and he'll ask me so many times, you know, he'll say, what do you think about this? And he's really asking my opinion. And I can't tell you the number of times I'll say, I don't agree with that, Dr. DePriest. He'll say, you don't? I'll say, no, sir, I don't. And I'll just adamantly not agree with it. Mm-hmm. Now, many times I come to discover on my own that he was right and I was wrong. Mm-hmm. And there's been many times he's called me up, even as of today, and said, you know what? I think you're right about this. Mm-hmm. And on a disagreement. But he allows me to be me. And he allows me, now, if it's an issue of, as an organization, we need to go a certain direction, and he may let me say my point, but when we walk out that door, if we've determined that we need to go in the direction that he thinks we need to go in, then that's the direction that we're going to go in. No one really knows about that disagreement except him and I behind closed doors. But he respected me in such a way to allow me to wrestle with him mentally about why I believed in what I believed in.
Yeah.
And here's a thing that I think, Mark, also to bring it back. Remember, a system is more than just a physical system like a car. You know, we call ours the Baptist Management System. So we've talked about this subject of variation with process behavior charts, and we've talked about treating people, and we brought up Peter Schultes and others. Mm-hmm. But another gentleman, now I'm gonna connect those two just like we would connect a car. Mm-hmm. And you quote Dr. Brian Joyner, and Dr. Brian Joyner has a great quote that when people are forced to hit a goal, a target, a number, mm-hmm. they do one of three things: they either distort the system, distort the data, or improve the system. Right.
Right. Right.
If they don't
have them doing the third, of course.
Right. If they don't know how to improve a system, and if they don't understand variation, then it's going to be natural for them to distort the data or distort the system. And a lot of times people misinterpret when they first hear that. They'll say, I'm not necessarily saying that someone's being intentionally deceptive. But many times people can distort a system or distort a data without knowing they're doing it. For example, in healthcare, if you bring up the subject of falls, the thing that comes out of someone's mouth instantly is, are those falls with harm or are those falls without harm? Hmm. And so we've started to I understand why we categorize the data. But a lot of the falls without harm is because you got lucky.
Well, and I think, I think it's that question of, are we categorizing or are we making excuses for? Or like, are we trying to better understand the problem so we can solve it? Or are we sort of excusing, or at least subtly excusing, that some of those falls were okay?
But that's an example of connecting understanding variation, understanding human psychology and people, right? And how do all those things work? So we think a lot about respect for people. That's a principle. We embrace the Shingo principles in our Baptist Management System, not just because I'm a Shingo examiner, but we embrace them as an organization. Our leader, Jason Little, our president and CEO, I don't know if there's been a week that's went by in the last 5 years that I haven't heard him talk about empathy, not just empathy for the patient, but empathy for the real folks that do the patient caring work, you know? Mm-hmm. And so I think without that element of respect for human beings and understanding the power and the creativity of people, that that everything else is, you could argue, is going to be impossible to do. Mm. Mm.
Even
another element of TWI that we're early on at introducing is job methods. The historians argue that Kaizen events, and a lot of them came out of an origin of job methods. I did a little video on our YouTube channel, me and Patrick, recently, and I was explaining that what one friend of mine, Dr. Alan Robinson, says is that job methods is nothing more than, he calls it, an idea activator. Mm-hmm. He's actually right about that, because what's really cool is you can get people together that they really don't know much about JM or a lot of the improvement, but they work in that process. And as long as someone can guide them through that process, what you're doing is you're questioning the process. So you're encouraging a questioning attitude. And through that process, you're trying to generate ideas. And it becomes a very creative process. But what you're really doing is you're celebrating people's creativity, which is also doing what? It's respecting them. It's honoring them.
Right. So I think we'll go ahead and wrap up. I mean, my gosh, there's so much at some point we could dig into. Let's do more podcasts when you have the time. But to wrap things up, I mean, maybe it's just, you know, open-ended question, or if there's some other final thought you want to share. You know, of the 14 points or, you know, other lessons for Deming, what's the one lesson that you wish more people would embrace today here in 2018, because it would be helpful?
I guess I'd really have to reflect on all 14, but I guess
it was a tough question I threw at you. Sorry.
Very tough. I guess the one that I reflect on the most, that I think about the most, is two thoughts that I think about the most. One would be his very first point about creating constancy of purpose. Mm-hmm. It's so easy to get distracted. I get that. You hear people talk about multitasking. I think there's even science out there that argues that you really can't multitask.
Right.
And so I would say that would be the point that I think about. But then, and I may mess this up, Mark, but you remember his quote where he says that a bad process will kind of ruin or destroy a good person every time.
Right. There's variations of that. Yeah. A bad system will defeat a good person every time or something.
Well, as you know, Mark, when we get into this work, that phrase comes to mind quite often. It came to my mind 2 weeks ago when I was looking at how nurses at a hospital handled IV pumps. And I remember thinking to myself, oh my gosh, this process is killing these poor nurses. Yeah. They just want an IV pump. And they're having to hunt and find and hoard, you know, and steal an IV pump, you know. And so I think those are the two that come to mind quite often.
Yeah. And I'll build on it maybe as a final thought, where again, like, you know, I think the influence of Dr. Deming on Toyota, the Toyota production system, is so clear. I think sometimes that has in a way gotten lost in translation into what we would generally call lean. But the expression I've heard, I always think back to Daryl Wilburn, who's an American who worked for Toyota for a long time. I have a chance to go to Japan with him in October to go and learn from him and others. But Daryl said these really profound words in the talk. He said, it's the responsibility of leaders to create a system in which people can be successful. And I mean, it's just, think that word responsibility. I just see too many cases where unfortunately, leaders are blaming individuals for the system, and those individuals don't have the ability, they're not empowered to improve the system, or it's a system perspective that's far beyond their level in the organization, regardless of how creative they are for Kaizen. There's the system design issue at a bigger picture. That's the one philosophy I wish more leaders would embrace.
That's good. That's real good.
And I think we can tie it to the statistical process control charts, because that, or AKA process behavior chart, will help us show what the system is capable of.
That's right. That's exactly right.
And also, let's you know, maybe we can come back to that question to kick off another podcast.
Absolutely.
We'd love to hear more about what you're working on there within Baptist in the context of the Baptist management system.
Love that. That'd be great.
Really enjoy, as always, having the chance to talk with you, Skip. And thanks so much for coming back and taking time to be part of the podcast.
Well, thank you for having me, Mark. I appreciate it.
Thanks for listening. This has been the Lean Blog Podcast. For lean news and commentary updated daily, visit www.leanblog.org. If you have any questions or comments about this podcast, email Mark at leanpodcast@gmail.com.
Hey, podcast listeners. I'm excited to announce the release of the audiobook version of my new book, The Mistakes That Make Us, Cultivating a Culture of Learning and Innovation. Listen and dive into powerful insights on fostering growth through mistakes. Whether you're a leader, entrepreneur, or just trying to get better at learning from mistakes, this audiobook is for you. Get it now on Audible, Amazon, and Apple Books. Visit mistakesbook.com for more info.